Hi, everyone. We really have an amazing treat today here at the OU. We have award-winning producer Rafi Marmor, who is visiting us. Over the course of the last couple of weeks, the screening that has really received tremendous acclaim throughout the industry and throughout the press of the Holocaust documentary that he's producing, No Place on Earth. Producer Rafi Marmor, if we could ask you, what was the story behind this film? And share with us a little bit about this film.
Sure. It's a pretty incredible story. I guess you could say all Holocaust survival stories are pretty incredible. This was one that we had never heard anything like before. And it's the story of 38 people, five families, who survived living in a cave for over 500 days. And what's amazing about this story is that everybody who went into the cave came out of the cave. Everybody lived, from grandparents in their 60s to a 2-year-old baby. And they survived in what is one of the most difficult environments, having been in this cave, spending several weeks while we filmed the movie. I can attest that it was not just that they walked in there and they had an easy place to hide. It's a very, very difficult environment in there, and they did something absolutely incredible. And that's the basis of the story in the film.
How were they discovered? In terms of their story, this unique group of communities in the Western Ukraine, would you share with us that story?
Yeah, well, that's another very interesting aspect of the film is the way into the story. A cave explorer named Chris Nicola, who is an ex-New York cop who became a kind of a big caving enthusiast, was mapping one of the longest caves in the world in Western Ukraine.
Just for our listeners, we're referring to underground caves, not the simple caves that we think of, but serious underground caves.
Yes, exactly. Just to add to that point, this particular cave is 77 miles long. It's the second longest cave in the world. So Chris was mapping this cave with some Ukrainian cavers, and they started finding very weird, like household objects in the cave. They found a woman's shoe. They found some buttons. They found keys. And they were, shocked because they were basically the first people down mapping this cave. And over the course of 9 years, it took Chris to investigate this story, to try to find out who was living in this cave. The Ukrainians in the surrounding areas were not very helpful. He went back and forth to Ukraine many, many times trying to piece together this mystery, and after about 9 years, he discovered this family that had this story that they were basically only telling within the family, and it happened to be these people who, it was their objects, and they were the ones who had survived in the cave.
I had the great honor of attending the screening and listening to the buzz from amongst the press corps and some of the film critics. People are already talking that this will be the film of the year, the documentary that will receive the Oscar. Could you go for a few minutes into, I can tell you myself, sitting and watching the film, the last 40 minutes I was on the edge of my seat. Yeah, I never thought once that this is a slow-moving. When you think of a documentary, it's usually something that moves much slower. How is it that this documentary had almost the suspense of a thriller, of an action film, and at the same time was back and forth with interviews of the survivors and had the sense of a documentary? How were you able to accomplish that?
We approached this documentary not like you would a normal documentary. We approached it more like a feature film. And that is to say, we brought in the talent of a feature film, and we approached the story like you would like you would a feature film. 60%, I would say, of the film is actually is a dramatic film, and which is, you know, very, very different from your traditional documentary, and that's interweaved with the stories and the interviews of the survivors. So, you know, the film, it's a very big film. It's a very epic film. And it feels more like a narrative feature film than it does a documentary, even though obviously it is a documentary.
If you would share with us for a few moments a little bit about your background. Participating in an OU shul, your family was very involved in the Young Israel Syracuse, then being an active member of the Young Professionals at the Beth Jacob of Beverly Hills. Share with us a little bit about your experiences and how you got into Hollywood and how you've become a producer.
Sure. Well, I grew up in upstate New York, outside of Syracuse. We were one of very few Orthodox families, Shomer Shabbat families, in the area. I moved after graduating from university. I moved out to Israel, where I lived for 4 years, and I worked at an animation company. And while I was there, I was on the business and marketing side of the company, and it was there that I started getting into the production side of things. And after leaving there, I formed my own production company. I made a documentary about a underground boxing club at Oxford University that ended up doing. It became a prominent documentary in the UK, and that kind of set me down the course of producing. I ended up moving to Los Angeles, where I met Rabbi Weil at Beth Jacob, where I'm a pretty active member there, specifically in the Young Professionals Minyan. Now currently live in Los Angeles, right actually across the street from Beth Jacob.
One thing I want to say for our listeners out there, Rafi Marmor was a co-producer of one of the most successful educational minyanim, beginner's minyan, that takes place every Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and that emerged to a once-a-month Shabbos experience and now takes place even more often, that attracts producers, directors, people from varied backgrounds, who this is a very healthy portal of entry to Judaism. And I want to thank Rafi for that. And this is something that's being modeled across the country, across the OU network.
And I'll just jump in on that as well, is that it's not only a beginner's minyan, it's also an explanatory minyan. And the idea is that it is equally for people who go to shul all the time as it is for people who it's their, you know, first time walking in. It kind of lets you know where you are, what you're saying, why you're saying what you're saying, as you kind of go through the davening. So, it's something pretty special.
Would you share with us what it was like working with this family of survivors, some of them in their 90s, some of them in their late 80s, the first time they go back to the place where they actually saved their lives, the cathartic experiences they had, and what it was like emotionally for them, their children, their grandchildren?
Yeah, I mean, it was an unbelievably emotional experience for everybody involved. We had brought back the four of the survivors, basically for the first time into the caves that saved their lives, and two of them had brought grandchildren with them, so that their grandchildren could go into and experience the cave. We were there with them for, I would say, about 2 weeks, and they would walk through the towns where, you know, it used to be, you know, basically all Jewish. Now there's not a single Jew left in the area. You know, they were pointing out the houses where their uncles and aunts and cousins lived, and which, you know, were either destroyed or not there anymore. What was also pretty incredible is that the place had pretty much not progressed at all from basically the 1930s when the Jews had had been removed from there. It was horses and carts around the streets, you know, absolutely just the most, you know, dire poverty you could see there. So that was also just very interesting. And the you know, the survivors engaging with the townspeople, talking, you know, recognizing that some of them were relatives or grandchildren of their neighbors, of the people who, you know, chased them out of town. Some of them, you know, killed their family members, and getting into, you know, really trying to engage the people there. It was an incredibly emotional experience for everybody.
One fact that one of the leading members of the family said was that, unlike many movies that are made of the Holocaust, this film was not dramatized. And I'm quoting him, he said it was 99.9% accurate. It was not exaggerated and it wasn't understated. How were you able to do that?
Well, we interviewed them several times. And, you know, it was very, very important to us, and it was very important to them that we did not exaggerate, that we kept things exactly as they happened. And, you know, we were interviewing, basically there were five different people that we interviewed. And we also had the writings of their mother, who was, you know, basically the hero of the story. And the director of the film as well, she comes from a network news background. And so she was, you know, just very, very didactic in making sure, you know, all the fact-checking that we had to do. It was very important, you know, for our team, but also very important for the survivors that everything was completely accurate and as it happened.
Would you share with us, the film is going to be opening for the public, I understand, in early April. And my understanding is in over 20 cities. I want to share a little bit about the background. I saw at the film that the History Channel had invested, that other corporations have invested, because they want to be involved in distributing this. Share with us what will be happening after Pesach with the openings.
Yeah, well, the film is being released by Magnolia Pictures. And it will be in theaters starting on April 5th, which is the weekend of Yom HaShoah that they're opening the film. And it's going to open first in New York in two theaters, the Sunshine Landmark Theater, I believe on Houston Street, and the new Lincoln Center Film Lincoln Center Film Theater. I'm not sure exactly what it's called, but I believe it's on 65th Street, right across from Juilliard. It's going to then expand from there to about 20 markets, including Los Angeles. It opens, I think, the week of April 12th. Chicago, I believe it opens the same weekend. St. Louis, the following weekend. Miami. Basically, you know, 20 of the large cities, which you can find, I'm sure, on Magnolia's website. It will then go to the History Channel, where it will air on the network, a primetime broadcast. I'm not sure that that's yet scheduled. Probably, you know, at some time, you know, in later 2013. It's also going to be premiering in Germany. It's going to have a wide theatrical release in Germany, I believe, starting in early May. So it's going to be all over the U.S. and the more people that go see it, the more they will expand it and bring it to more cities. So I definitely encourage everybody who can to get out there and see it, and if you like it, to spread the word to as many people as you can on your Facebook, on your Twitter, in your shul bulletins, whatever you can help to get the film out there.
And that film is No Place on Earth.
Yes, No Place on Earth.
Would you care to speak to us just for a few moments about the other film that you're going to be releasing later this year? I understand it's going to be released in the summer.
I do have another film that is just coming out, just actually was released in the South by Southwest Film Festival. Actually, it won the Audience Award there, called The Short Game, which is about the best 7-year-old golfers in the world. Obviously, a very different film from No Place on Earth, and that will hopefully be in theaters later this year.
Now, why did you do a film and explain to the audience about 7-year-old golfers?
Yeah, the concept just fascinated me. One, it being such an old person's sport, or generally considered such an old person's sport, and watching, it being played by kids who you would normally think want to be running around and kicking balls and, you know, whatever sports kids usually play. This is a sport that requires an incredible amount of focus and concentration, you know, not things that are associated with little kids generally. The level of accomplishment of these kids. I mean, these kids they're hitting 10 under par literally in tournaments. They can beat anybody I've ever seen play golf, and they're also hilarious and engaging little kids at the same time. So the subject matter just really interested me, and then when we started filming, we saw that it was going to be an incredible film, which, thank God, it turned out to be.
And this, you filmed this on multiple continents.
Yes, we filmed this in China, the Philippines, South Africa, England, France, and then all over the U.S. as well. I mean, we found the best 7-year-old golfers in the world, so it took us all over the place.
So if we want to know who the next Tiger Woods is, Rafi, you're the person we should be asking.
That is for sure.
If I could go back to No Place on Earth, you filmed quite a bit of it in Ukraine, quite a bit of it in Hungary. Would you share with us why you went to Hungary and what you did there? And would you also share with us, my understanding was maybe some of the not so pleasant experiences of going back to the Ukraine?
Yeah. We filmed the cave that they actually survived in. We did a lot of filming there with the survivors themselves, and with a small crew. But it was a very, very difficult cave to get in and out of, and to bring equipment in there was difficult enough. But to have all of the actors that were part of the dramatic part of the film, and there's a lot of actors. Some scenes had up to 40 or so actors in them, and child actors, and it would have been absolutely impossible to film it in the cave where it actually happened. It was just too treacherous and difficult. So we shot a lot of the dramatic part of the film in Hungary and in Slovakia, where they have caves that are very similar, they're gypsum caves, which, not all caves are gypsum caves. And they were of similar size and just were a lot easier to get in and out of. You could actually drive trucks into one of the caves where we did a lot of the filming. So that's why we did a lot of the dramatic stuff in Hungary. Also, the reception in Ukraine was not as friendly as we would have liked. I think that I don't know that they love the idea of us coming in there to tell this story and to make this film in general. It was, for the several weeks that we were there filming with bringing the survivors back there, there was not the most friendly atmosphere, I would put it.
And you're being quite understated at this point.
Yeah, it was. We were not really welcomed there. In Ukraine, we kind of felt it all the time and at every turn. So practically speaking, as well, it just made a lot of sense to shoot in a place where, A, they have a much bigger film community, and B, where we knew we would be much more welcomed.
The Righteous Gentile, the former New York police officer Christopher Nicola. Which is a fascinating angle in this film, that this story came about through his search. Which he was really searching his own roots, and here it is that he discovers the story of the Jews there. He was stonewalled, my understanding from his remarks after the film, he was stonewalled for multiple years There had been rumors that there were Jews in the caves, and no one would respond to him until finally he had to take a different route by not asking the Ukrainians who lived there, who were stonewalling him, but actually having to go to social media and try to find the story of the Jews.
Yeah, he got, you know, pretty much no help from the many, many trips he took there. You know, I don't think that people wanted him discovering this. I don't know that they knew the story, but they certainly didn't want to help him on his journey to find the story. So yeah, he ended up. This was in the days before really the explosion of the internet. This was in the early 90s when he was searching, when he started the search. And yeah, he was, you know, at first it was going to libraries and bookstores and you know, really doing as much physical research as he could as well on the ground in Ukraine, asking as many, you know, people questions as he could. You know, then by the time, you know, he actually started, you know, making some headway was when, you know, there was all the online resources, and he was able to post things onto message boards and use some social media to, you know, track down a relative of the family who, you know, recognized what he was looking for, said, "I think this might be, this is my family that you're looking for," sent him a random email one day, and that's how he connected the story.
Wow. Rafi, in the event that any of our congregations or day schools out there, anyone who's listening, would want to do, let's say, either for a fundraiser or a Yom HaShoah event, probably Yom HaShoah is not feasible, but a Tisha B'Av event, where would they go to contact to see if they could have access where they could do a special showing of the film? How would they go about doing that?
Well, they could definitely contact me. And I can help put them in touch with Magnolia Pictures. That's the distribution company. But you can also contact Magnolia Pictures directly. You know, they're very interested in helping, you know, get groups into the cinemas and to, you know, help as many people as possible see this movie.
Okay. Is it feasible, and again, this may be out of your jurisdiction, but is it feasible, let's say, that it could be shown in a congregation on a Tisha B'Av afternoon, or that'll be challenging?
To tell you the truth, I don't know. I'd be speaking somewhat out of turn, because I think that would be a question for Magnolia to answer. So I'm not too sure about that. Like the idea of it, though.
People should Google Magnolia Films.
Yeah, Magnolia Pictures. I think it's magpictures.com.
Magpictures.com. Thank you. I want to thank, first and foremost, Dan Jesselson. Not only is he one of the top bass guitar players in all of New York, but he's really the one who runs this. And we want to thank him for the recording. And I want to thank our chief communications officer, Mayor Furtick, who's also helped us put this together today. Rafi, any last comments you want to share with our listening audience?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, just to reinforce the idea that this is it's a very important film. And it's one that, you know, I think it approaches the Holocaust in a very new and interesting way, and it engages a younger audience about the Holocaust in a way that I don't think has ever been done before. The heroes of this story are 14-year-old boys, 18-year-old boys. These were the guys who would leave the cave and actually, you know, steal the food and risk their lives, you know, every few weeks to bring in the supplies, where, you know, the adults basically never left the cave the entire time. So it's a way of engaging the younger generation in the Holocaust, or in education about the Holocaust, in a totally new way. So I think it's just important for people to go out and see the film and to talk about the film and to get younger people to see the film and to spread the word.
One last question. One thing that was nice to see, the families that survived, they settled in Montreal, they settled other places, they did quite well after the Shoah. In other words, the ingenuity that they had to live in what Christopher Nicholas said was just impossible circumstances, that even someone like him, an explorer like himself, probably could have never survived that. That same ingenuity is something that they employed when they came to these shores and literally built businesses, built families. And any comments about that?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Saul Sturmer, who was one of the main heroes in the cave, I believe he was 21 at the time, and he was kind of the engineering brains behind. They built secret exits. They had to have systems of getting people in and out. And he was the builder. That was what he did. And today, at I believe 92 years old, he runs a very successful, still to this day, runs a very successful construction company in Montreal. So yeah, it's very inspirational that they all came back. They didn't come back. They came to Canada. Actually, one came to the U.S. and ended up, yeah, just creating wonderful lives with, a lot of grandchildren and did just very well for themselves.
Thank you, Rafi. We want to wish you a tremendous amount of success on both films and in all of your endeavors. And we at part of the extended OU family, we're very proud that we have a person like yourself with the great substance that you have, and you've taken the talents that you've had and really use them to the benefit of your people and to the benefit of commemorating the legacy of those who suffered and those who survived. God bless you, and we want to wish you, your family, a wonderful Pesach. And once again, on behalf of everyone, is the OU family, this has been a very busy day. We know you've been meeting with the Times, Diane Sawyer, that you made time to come to talk to our community. We're very, very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi, and thank you for having me on.